and David.
Great show.
Thank you.
Goodness. Fantastic. So we draw a lot of owls at Pottermore, so I want that slide for the team back in London. No, really fantastic. And also I'll be in for the 1 year of free Azure as well. So I'm Julian Thomas. I'm the Chief Technology Officer at Pottermore. And this is
David. And my name is David Aiken, and I'm a Windows Azure Specialist at Microsoft. And this is going to make no sense, but this is showing the wrong thing.
We need some notes.
Thank you. Possible. And we're going to wait. So let's talk a little bit about Pottermore, just to get things rolling then. So some of you might have already seen Pottermore, but I'm going to leave you with Julian for a little while. He's going to talk through what Pottermore is, what the challenges were, and how we thought about moving this application to Windows Azure in about 3 months. So Julian, what is Pottermore?
Thank you, David. So before we start, I just want to talk to the Slytherin thing. Don't be disturbed by that. We're good people, really. Slytherin House has had some great wizards over the years, including Merlin, and obviously Snape, who is another favourite. So we'll just shoot on to... here we go. What is Pottermore? So Pottermore, for those that don't know, is a collaboration with Sony that includes Pottermore.com, which is a unique digital experience from J.K. Rowling, built around the 7 Harry Potter stories. It's also got the Pottermore shop, which made the Harry Potter ebooks available for the first time in various open formats, EPUB 3, DRM 3. So the 7 books that J.K. Rowling wrote are just a very narrow corridor through an amazing world that she created. If you were to talk to Jo and ask her what was happening, say, in other classrooms while Harry was at his first potions class in the Sorcerer's Stone, she could tell you what was going on, what Hermione was doing, what other people were doing. And if you were to talk to Jo a year later and ask the same question, she'd tell you exactly the same thing. So Pottermore is about exploring that world. Let me show you a little bit more about what it's about. So, that was a whistle-stop tour of what is a very rich site. Pottermore.com is free to join, and it's the place to explore more of the magical world of Harry Potter. It's a balance of social and content and interactive features. So you can have a wand choose you at Ollivander's, you can be sorted into a Hogwarts house, build a network of friends, then challenge them to a duel, brew potions and compete for the House Cup, and read exclusive new content from the world of Harry Potter direct from J.K. Rowling herself. As with any new site, the size of the audience is always somewhat uncertain. Those of you who are down in Silicon Valley, maybe in startups, you know, you hope that the week you launch your site, it'll suddenly explode, but it may take a few months for that to happen. And then when it does happen, you don't know the rate at which it's going to grow. We had the same challenge at Pottermore. You know, we knew that Harry Potter was big, but we didn't know what audience was going to come. So a bit more about the size of Harry Potter. So Harry Potter is arguably the largest entertainment franchise the world has seen. At the last count, over 450 million physical books sold. And of those, translated into 70 languages. I believe the most recent is Breton, which is a dialect from Western France. Also, over 5 billion movie theatre tickets. So even before we opened up Pottermore, you know, the digital manifestation of Harry Potter and the stories, we had some pretty big numbers of our own. So J.K. Rowling announced Pottermore to the world in late June 2011. We started a registration process for the limited beta, which began on the 31st of July. That's an auspicious date in our world. It's both J.K. Rowling's birthday and also Harry's birthday. So we ran a magical quill competition to select people for the beta, and we had to cap it after 1 million fans signed up within a matter of days. So we started inviting the first sort of 100,000 of that audience onto the site from the 15th of August. We immediately saw unprecedented engagement from that audience, in consuming the content from Joe, engaging in Wizard Dueling. We immediately hit a wall. So the immediate response was to turn off features, dial stuff down. Wizard Dueling went within hours. And then we were riding out the demand from that audience. We led a few more on, so we had a tranche of 100,000, then another 100,000. And having set the expectation back when we launched the beta that we'd be opening to the whole world in October, it took us to October to get through those million and get them all on the site. So we had to keep that beta closed. We had mounting pressure. And at late October, open to all seemed a very long way off. So we also had a huge uncertainty. What would happen when we did open to all? How many would come? So that takes us to November 2011, which is when I arrived at Pottermore as the CTO, Pottermore's first CTO. So I arrived to an on-premise solution. It was built on Windows Server, and it had a single database with kind of more of a scale-up story than a scale-out story. The architecture approach selecting an on-premises solution was decided way back in early 2010 when Pottermore was a secret project. It didn't even have that name. So at that time, the team were sort of selecting a technical architecture, but they didn't quite know what Pottermore would be. Again, something in a startup. You know, you often have a core idea, but actually how that realizes itself can change as you get the team in place and start building it. So originally, back in early 2010, it was a bit more content-focused. It was about delivering that extra content from J.K. Rowling. There was less of the interactive features planned, less of the social. So an on-premise solution to a certain scale with a thick layer of CDN over the top was the selected choice. Also, it's worth saying, you know, back in early 2010, cloud was not as mature as it is now. Naturally, there were concerns about data security and reliability. Those concerns felt more real back then. But it was a really difficult situation which I faced in November. You know, not only had we hit that wall, we'd just about got through the beta audience, they were still engaged, we'd kept under our limits, but no one could tell me what was going to happen when we did open it up. You know, the ranges of estimates of audience, would 2 million come in the week, would 20 million come in the first week? There were wild estimates. As I've shown you, we know that everything in Harry Potter has always been bigger than anyone could anticipate. So how many SQL Server licenses to buy? How many boxes to stuff into the data center? It just couldn't answer those questions. So clearly, we needed an elastic platform and a scalable architecture, particularly refactoring the data tier. So why Windows Azure? Having recognized quickly that cloud was a big part of the Pottermore scale solution, I looked to all the credible providers in the market. With a Microsoft code base and the speed to market being absolutely critical, as well as making it to web scale, Windows Azure soon selected itself. I think it was in December, I went out to Redmond's, caught up with David Akin and some of the other team in Windows Azure. And, you know, we envisaged a project to move Pottermore to the cloud. I needed an elastic solution, clearly uncertain but massive demand. I also wanted my relatively small technology team focused on delivering a hugely creative experience that you saw in the video, not necessarily on managing infrastructure, rolling out servers, provisioning. And I needed that quick route to scale. I was already late the day I arrived in the job. So by January 2012, we had an engineering team on the ground and started the project, which I called Pottermore to the Cloud. So what did that project look like? We had 1 million live users on the site. We had about 160,000 lines of code. And I gave the team 3 months. I wanted it sort of by Q2. So 3 months of engineering effort. We needed to lift and shift the application we had with the minimum amount of code changes. I'm now going to hand over to David. He'll tell you a little bit more about that story and how the project went.
Brilliant. Thanks, Julian. So there's a couple of numbers Julian doesn't share with you and some things he did. First of all, Julian's way taller than most of the team that worked on Pottermore, and he wrote the date up on the top of the whiteboard, and we couldn't kind of get to it, so we were kind of stuck on that. The other great thing he did is he wouldn't tell us how many users were coming on because we didn't know. So this gives us a little bit of a problem of how big of a thing do we really need to build? Are we going to scale this to 100 million users or 1 million users or one user? Like, nobody had really any idea how big it was because they had to cap off that registration process in the beta before we knew how big that initial spike was. The other great thing about this is we had one database server. Now, if you're moving to a cloud, you're going to be scaling out, not up. There isn't a button in Windows Azure that said, add more SSD drives to Windows Azure. There wasn't one that said, you know, go and put a few more Fusion I/O cards in or wherever it is, right? You've got to think about things differently. So what I want to do in the next 10 minutes or so is share some of the things that we came up with, some of the challenges that we had, how Windows Azure helped, and some of the things we had to really think about. Now, you might think, oh, big corporate Microsoft here, standing talking to a bunch of doers, as we've just seen. The dev team and the whole team on this was pretty small. I would say the core dev team was 10 people, less than that. So we're not talking about hundreds of engineers going in, doing all sorts of amazing stuff. We had a few developers on the ground, and really were able to pull this off quite quickly. The architecture, I'm not going to dwell too long on the architecture on this, but it's a typical kind of multi-tier architecture. This was designed for an on-premises solution, so we had to go and kind of lift this up and push it into Windows Azure and change a few things. We've got some things, typical web front end. We've got some interactive APIs. We've also got some dependencies on third-party systems, email provider, and also comment moderation were two to mention. So we had these third-party dependencies that we had to take with us to the cloud as well. Then we had some back-end functionality as well, just to, you know, pre-populate the cache, do some of those routine jobs, clear up user assets and that kind of thing. And then because we encrypt all of the user data, we've got a decryption service built in as well. So we kind of took these and pretty much that maps, just for those that go, oh, I wonder how they built that. That obviously is a bit of a dumbed down version of the architecture, so it fits on a slide. But we basically lifted that and all of those mapped across into the web and worker roles that Scott talked about earlier in the cloud services session. So really, you know, we didn't have the websites, we didn't have VMs to play with, we had cloud services, web roles and worker roles. So we had to go and lift this application and push it in there. That was actually pretty quick. Getting the code to run inside a cloud service was pretty quick. We saw a demo of it earlier where we did that, and it was almost as quick as that. There were, however, some great things that cloud services give us. We had 7 or 8 different environments all running the same code. We had a test environment for functional testing. So this is when I click here, does it actually do something? Then we had 4 or 5 environments at one point to do load testing and performance testing. I'm going to talk about that. We also had a pre-production environment and a production environment as well. So we were being very kind of very hardcore about the process of getting a build from dev through the different cycles, passing all the quality bars and into production. You can imagine with a brand like Pottermore, you can't go and throw something up and, oh, you click on this button, it all barfs, it all has to work. So we've got this quality thing. Now, what's great about cloud services is you can just really go and build these new environments, spin them up, deploy the application, do your testing, and tear them back down again. To do this in an on-premises world where you're dealing with physical machines and dealing with setting up the network and configuring all of that, you just can't do it unless you've got a huge, massive budget and lots of spare time. We were able to provision environments very quickly. I'd say it took from end to end, and this is a provisioning the databases and things like that, you're talking between 30 minutes and an hour to go and spin up a couple of hundred instances, all configured readily to do some load testing. So that just saved us a huge amount of time. We were able to spin up multiple environments. We were also able to scale those environments up, so when we were ready to test at a higher load, we could just turn the dial up and we'd get more instances. We didn't have to worry about dealing with the infrastructure required to have more servers running the app. Windows Azure just did all of those things for us. Now, I'd be a complete jinx if I came away and said, you're just gone with this magic button and everything is going to work, right? There were some challenges, right? We couldn't just lift the application and have it run directly in Windows Azure. We did some things for all different reasons. One of the first things we did was we collapsed the tiers down. Rather than having all of these different pieces of code running across several servers, we brought it all together. We did that for a few reasons. First of all, the security boundary changed when we went to the cloud, and that's something to think about. On premises, you're in a lot of control of the firewalls and where all the devices are. In the cloud, we take care of that, but it's a particular shape. So with that shape in mind, we did some adjustments and we changed the security boundaries. We also optimized the application for latency and brought some of the heavily compute pieces together. We did a lot of work to change some of the async thing, some of the synchronous things to asynchronous. So for example, when you add a comment, it goes through the moderation service. Turns out we don't really need to get it there super quick and get it back super quick. We could buffer these up and go and write them down in batches. And this just kind of offloaded some things from the system. We also had a look at the database access. Remember, we had one database server on premises, and we moved to a whole bucket full in the cloud. In fact, let's talk about that. So our one database server, there were numerous databases. And two of the main ones, there were several supporting ones, but two of the main ones has the user profile, which is all about user X, and also the user activity, which is what things they've done on the site. Now, one of the challenges with Pottermore is it's not just serving up static content. If I go on, I'll get an experience that's customized based upon how I've progressed through the books. So I'll see different views in all the way through the books, different information about characters. So it's very customized to the single user. Depending on which house I belong to, what portions I've brewed, my experience is different. So this wasn't a case of, oh, here's a news article, let's go and push that out, cache it heavily, because everybody's going to get the same thing. This was very kind of customized. So in the end, we kind of had around 500 databases. Now, what's really good is creating the 500 databases, I'll talk a little bit more about this, but we didn't click 500 times to create databases. We wrote a little script to do that, because we created 500 databases lots of times. But you know, that gives you some more challenges, because now if I want to bring a page back that has all of the activities that my friends have done, I've got this kind of follower problem. So if I've got a website and I need to go and, you know, let's say I'm friends with five of you in the room here, and I need to go and find you, I need to know, first of all, which one of those 500 databases are you in? So we need a way of looking up users. Then we need a way of kind of doing a query, and, you know, typical kind of finite query across things. Now, that works great. It works great on paper. It works great when you build the code and you hit F5, and that's fantastic. And then you go and put 80,000 users against it, and you start kind of wondering about this. So finding queries across hundreds of databases can be quite an expensive operation. It turns out that about 98% of the users within Pottermore had less than 100 friends. So we weren't too worried that we were going to get Twitter-style Justin Bieber kind of followers on there, although we have three of them and we're trying to decide if they're test accounts or not, or if it's just Julian. So fan out's expensive. We've got to build an app that can handle not getting a response back. What we couldn't wait for is if we had hit 10 databases, we don't want to wait until all 10 respond. So we want to kind of disconnect that. And if we get half a dozen answers back, let's go and render that within a certain time frame and meet an SLA and make sure the user's got a good experience. Now, all these things, you're like, well, I know what it's like to build minimum viable product, and you don't think through these things, and then you take off. And one of the big challenges with Pottermore was we didn't have any runway at all to start scaling this up and fixing things on the fly. We knew from day one we weren't going to get a couple of thousand users coming along. Hell, we got 10 million a million beta registrations in 10 hours. So that gave us a good ballpark. We couldn't grow this organically. We had to go and try and get some things right. So 500 databases, how do you update the statistics across 500 databases? So scripting's your friend. I believe that the term we use now, which is pretty cool, DevOps. DevOps is all about not clicking the mouse, I guess. We built a whole bunch of scripts to update databases, do schema changes, populate tables, rebuild caches, deploy into Windows Azure. Everything you've seen today and all the things certainly we use, which was a subset, has an API behind it and can be scripted through PowerShell or build your own. It's a REST API. Okay? And that was really, really, I can't begin to tell you how powerful that was. Because you know what? If I had to create 500 databases, and I've done it because we didn't have it at some point, is a nightmare. So then we kind of go, okay, we've got this site running. We've solved a lot of the architectural problems. What about this performance thing? And we did two things. One is we looked at individual query performance. How fast can I get a single response through the system? And again, it's not that straightforward. It's not just I'm bringing back a single page with a news article or a bunch of comments. I have to customize this based on my experience and get that back to me. And this happens to thousands and hundreds of thousands of users concurrently. So we have to get that single transaction really speedy quick. The great news is moving to the cloud where you're executing your code has changed, but a lot of the tools that you're familiar with in terms of performance analyzing databases, tuning queries, and all those kind of things are going to be the same. Then we went on to load testing. Load testing was fantastic. We were scratching our heads and we needed to create 50,000 users at one point. How can we simulate 50,000 users? We spun up Visual Studio test system, we deployed it to Windows Azure, and we used Windows Azure to go and test itself, which was pretty good. We were able to very quickly spin up more environments, and again, when we looked at how would we build this on premises, we just couldn't think of how we could quickly go and build these test harnesses to go and deliver some load. Now, the great thing about being able to kind of go and simulate load against your site, which is really good, is it uncovers a whole bunch of really cool stuff that you didn't really want to find, really, if I'm honest. One of them was this. It's CPU 50%. Didn't matter whether there was one user on or 10,000 users on, it was 50%. And it was pretty cool because it took us a little bit of time to kind of wonder what's going on here. Is there something broke? In the end, because we can RDP into the box, even on a cloud service, we can still remote desktop in. We remote desktop in, we got some crash dumps. We had a look at the memory and the code paths, and we found a bit of code that was causing it, and we managed to fix it. And it was the same tools that we're used to using on our local boxes in our local data center. We didn't have to reinvent the wheel with any of these things. So telemetry is really important. When you've got one server or five servers, it's easy to go and load up Perfmon and have a look at the things. When you've got 300 instances, you need to start thinking a little bit differently. CPU average across 300 instances will hide something pegged at 100%. Everything, do the math,
let's say everything's at 10% and one of them's at 100%, it's going to show up as about 12% or something ridiculously low like that. I just made that number up in case all the people online have gone, that's not right. So you need to use a whole bunch of tools to be able to do this. Fortunately, Windows Azure will do a good job of collating all of the information and putting it into blob storage. And then we've got some fantastic partners, some of which Scott talked about earlier, which can help kind of analyze these things. We got a lot of noise from 300 instances, 200,000 trace messages per second, and we were looking for one particular message that told us which server and which database had a problem. Yeah. We were looking at five-minute windows, if it helps. Do the math on that. Yes, that wasn't very a good experience. So we had to kind of look at all the tools across the board, and we ended up using a variety of tools, some of which were from our partners and enabled us to go and find the needle in the haystack. Some of them you'll be familiar with. Some of them we actually built in-house on top of the diagnostics that Windows Azure provides. My favorite, which is going to scroll along the bottom there, we've heavily hid all of the kind of juice there, but it's called Bacon Sandwich. Being from the UK, you'll appreciate the kind of baconness. And the phrase is, everything's better with bacon. And what Bacon Sandwich does is it gives you a view on the application. So we plotted out CPU, we plotted out the error rate that we were finding in the logs, and that gave us the kind of heartbeat of the application. We've got some great partners that we've talked about earlier that can do that kind of thing now for you, which is really good. The last thing I want to talk about is the actual kind of controls we put in for launch. We really thought, what if the experience failed somehow? What if we got something wrong? What if we got too many users, or something went wrong and we had a bad experience for the end users? Well, what we needed to be able to do is kind of turn off some of the features on that. So that's something else to think about when you're building your product. What would your application degrade to if there was an outage? Now, remember, we had these third parties. We're not in control of those. We also had, we're using the platform. Yes, we have an SLA. Yes, it's rock solid, but never say never. What happens if there's an issue there? What happens if we're doing an upgrade? How do you deal with all those kind of things? So we decided to put a load of controls in to be able to turn off elements of the application if we needed to. Now, I'm going to ask Julian to come back on and talk about launch, but I was so confident that launch was going to go well, I was actually sitting on a beach in Hawaii while launch was going on. So I'm going to hand it back to Julian, who's going to talk through some numbers with you.
Thank you, David. Thank you. It is fair to say he did work pretty hard right up until the Hawaiian vacation, along with some other guys who are here today as well. So catch up with them later if you're staying for the party. So launch. I guess the fact that we're both here today tells you the team nailed it. For Open to All, we scaled up the platform to accommodate some of the wildest traffic projections. You know, is it 20 million users coming within a week? And you know, you see some of the numbers there. So about 1,000 cores and 500 databases. That's a mixture of profile databases, activity databases, various other ways we map things out. So on the 14th of April, so pretty much 3 months from when the team landed on the ground in mid-January, we launched Pottermore to the World on a Saturday morning with a single tweet. It was actually for the guys back in Redmond, it was Friday the 13th, but for me it was Saturday the 14th, so it was all right. And that tweet just said, Pottermore, we're opening to everyone. So within a few minutes, it was picked up, we saw Twitter light up, and the traffic started to flood in. It was pretty exciting. Ultimately, you know, it went like a swan, you know, gliding across the water. There was some furious paddling underneath, but way less than I ever anticipated. It was very smooth. And the numbers were big. So within about 2 weeks, we'd done 1 billion page views. And our peak day, which I said for those of you here earlier, we did about 110 million page views a couple of days in. I think, someone I'm sure will correct me online if I'm wrong, but someone like the Huffington Post is doing about 30-odd million a day. So we're pretty busy, particularly for a non-news site. And today, if you go to Pottermore, we're approaching... When you first join, you're not sorted into a house, so you enjoy the first part of the story, but we're approaching very nearly 3 million very engaged wizards and witches who are sorted into Hogwarts houses. So how's Windows Azure going to help us in the coming months? We see our traffic pattern, very difficult to forecast, as being a series of steps. Open to all was the first peak. You know, we're going to have needing this elastic platform to accommodate that peaky demand. We're now, you know, the half-life of a user on average is about 7 days. They spend time, there's a lot of stuff to read, a lot of stuff to engage in. You've got to take your shopping list to Diagon Alley and buy your spell books. And so people take about 7 days to do that. Some people then stay. You know, some engage with the social features. Others fight furiously for the House Cup. I think this morning Slytherin was still in the lead. So we were, nothing to do with anything I've done on the back end there. And then later this summer we're going to be launching the Chamber of Secrets, book two. So we anticipate, again, a spike. We'll have that audience that's there and engaged, and it'll naturally attract more people as it lights up on Twitter and Facebook. And then we'll anticipate settling down again. You know, we're going to deliver more interactive features, more sticky features, and then the journey goes on. We've got 7 books to get through, and then more beyond that. So, you know, I guess the question is that how would I have navigated this in on-premise? You know, we've got some real peaky demands and a very large demand. You know, right now we're dialing stuff down. And, you know, we've got plenty of capacity there, but we can do that. And then we'll dial up in preparation for releases and new stuff going on the site. And then where do we go from here? So with Pottermore, we're going to continue telling the stories in a unique way with the Chamber of Secrets coming this summer. And J.K. Rowling will be revealing more about the stories about the world of Harry Potter, and it will start to surface Pottermore wherever the audience is. So you'll see it on new devices and new platforms. Ultimately, the core delivered back on Windows Azure. So some of you who have been following what's been going on down at E3 this week will have seen an announcement in partnership with Sony around Wonderbook Book of Spells that's a PS3 augmented reality book, digital book. And the Book of Spells was by Miranda Goshawk, and it was published 200 years ago. And we're realizing that on PlayStation, but that connects back to Pottermore. And so there's a connection there. And we'll be expanding into new languages. Right now, you can enjoy Pottermore in US English, UK English, French, Italian, German, Spanish. And soon we'll be launching with some other languages, particularly some Far Eastern languages. So thank you for your time. And do check out Pottermore if you haven't already. I do want to thank the team at Microsoft, done a fantastic job, and you know, we're really confident in the platform we're on, and looking forward to certainly some of the stuff Scott was talking about earlier. It's going to be hugely powerful for us. We've already got some components in that architecture, such as moderation, which, you know, are not part of our core app, and being able to spring up services that are delivering stuff on other platforms is hugely powerful. So thank you, David.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Julian. So I just want to wrap up real quick here with a few things. Thank you. They've just scrolled my notes up, so I know what to say. So a few things. First of all, I want to thank everybody online and who made it down here in person for this event. I hope you've seen some really exciting things from both Scott and some of our partners. You've seen some of the new features, Windows VMs, as well as Linux VMs running in Windows Azure, and a great collection of partners to support that. You heard from one of them, Rightscale, here at the event. Bill Stables showed us about websites and how we can quickly deploy from a variety of platforms. So we did the Windows, ASP.NET, Visual Studio Experience. We also looked at how we, with our Mac, can go and push out using Git and use things like Node.js. And again, we've got a great selection of partners there, some of which you saw. We've heard from Twilio. We also have Cloud9 IDE. Who also have just today provided support for websites as well. They previously supported cloud services, but today they've just finished the work on the websites, and you can go and do that as well now. So please do check out the Chalk Talks online and sign up for the free trial at meetwindowsazure.com.